I am Gal Khalif, Seth Natania Hill, and you are in the Royal Priesthood Bible Prayer and Fellowship Room. And in honor of Miss Georgia Jackson, we have blown shofar on this Thanksgiving Day. And remember these all important words. And those of you that are in the Royal Room on this Thanksgiving Day, we are in the room. We're going to have a discussion tonight. We're going to have some talk tonight. We have a very special treat. We're going to get this out tonight. We are continuing our theme of wealth creation through procreation. And we're talking about this in the context of some things that we need to do. I have a lot of information, just tons of information that we can share on this subject. We are delighted tonight and extremely blessed to have a young man that's one of the ministers of the nation. His name is Asa Raguel Shema. Asa Raguel Shema, a.k.a. Robert Elijah. He is a minister of the nation, and he's 24 years old, and he's going to talk to us tonight about this situation that we have from a historical perspective and from a contemporary perspective. And we're going to project to talk about some solutions to the situation, because we don't want to get lost in analysis. So we are going to have a lively discussion on this evening. So I see a 510-207. How are you today? 510-207. I won't give the last four numbers. Speak up. How are you? 510-207 prefix. How are you? Can you hear me? All right. What about 510-586? Can you hear me? Steph, are you there? Am I coming through? Hello. Can you hear me? 510-586.
I'm sorry, sir. I was on mute. I hear you.
Okay, good deal. All right, well, make sure I'm coming through out there. Just getting a spot check there to see if I'm coming through. 510-207, can you hear me? Are you on mute as well? 510-207. All right. Well, I guess you're a little shy there. Don't want to come in, okay? But we're going to start this discussion tonight. We've been looking at the African so-called American community as a planned minority. By planned minority, I mean that there are some things, some policies, some programs, some things that are in place to ensure that the African American community remains trapped in the underclass, now beneath the minorities that are coming in. By that I mean the African-American community at one time was the first minority right behind Europeans in this country. But now they are pushed and forced beneath that position by the influx of immigrants coming in, primarily Hispanics and Asians, and they have lost the position of being the first minority and slipped out of second position and third position behind the Asians and behind the Hispanics. And now they are trapped in the underclass and are being eliminated, actually, through various means. They're being eliminated. As ugly as we, as that may seem, and as difficult as it may be to talk about, and as much as we may want to ignore it, we are being eliminated as a people genetically. There are lots of ways that is happening. Prison system is one way, because the black man is being taken out of society. He's being taken out of society, out of the social structure. Then he cannot procreate, he cannot reproduce. And that means that his numbers as a genetic species is declining. The other phenomena that's happening is the phenomena of homosexuality. The rise of homosexuality, men with men, same sex, is reducing his numbers as well. So now we're seeing that with the influx of immigration and immigrants coming in, and we see his incarceration rate, along with homosexuality, along with the mortality rate, homicides that are going on, he is looking at genetic extinction if he doesn't do something very quickly. And I'm excited tonight. I'm excited because we have a young man here that's going to talk to us a little bit about the history, how this all got started, and how we started the situation in this country. And he's going to talk to us. Again, his name is Asa, A-S-A, Asa Raguel Shema, a.k.a. Robert Elijah. How are you doing, Rob?
Doing pretty good, sir. How is everyone doing? Okay, I came to start out. First, I like to start out that blacks right now is psychologically damaged over 13,000 years or more of slavery, not including the 400 years of slavery in America, the 200 years of slavery in America, 1700. But I'm talking about slavery since in Africa.
Okay.
In 765, Arabs started to enslave blacks in Africa in 765, which started a phenomenon that's going on now. With that, it caused a lot of damage to us right now, because us as a people, we is damaged. Oh, okay. I would like to also start off by saying, I'm sorry, I'm getting tongue-tied right now. Sorry about that. But I would like to say that
what we have here, as he's getting himself together, he had a little situation here. Hold on, just pause for a moment. And what we have here in America is a situation where we were brought, some of us were brought here as slaves and then mixed in with others that were already here. And as we were mixed in with as slaves, the slave trade actually started with the Arabs 1,300 years ago. And they began, but it wasn't the kind of slavery that we looked at in the Americas. And as we progressed up through slavery, we found out that slavery continued and has had some devastating effects. I hear you there, Bishop. Are you there? Bishop, you got some background noise there. I got you. Okay. Slavery has some devastating effects on the black psyche and on the black mind. And what ended up happening, I see Brother Curry is in the line, too. Are you there, Brother Curry?
Yes, sir, I am, and good evening.
Hey, sir, how you doing? We have a young man here that's talking to us now. We're going to talk, we've been talking a little bit about the black people in this country as a planned minority, and we were looking at it from a historical standpoint, and we were going back to the beginning of slavery for the people of Africa, all the way back to the 700s, 700 AD, which was 1,300 years ago, by the Arabs, and we were moving forward. And a lot of people don't know that the Arabs were probably one of the first ones that started slave trades that is related to Africa at the beginning in the onslaught of the Arab aggression across North Africa as they began to try to push their way for the resources of Africa across the African continent. Unfortunately, they were not able to go beneath the Sahara Desert to go into sub-Sahara territory, but they did start the African slave trade, which was not based upon race at that point. And in the old world, slavery was based upon if you owe someone a debt, you will become an indentured servant or something, or for religious purposes. And that was a third reason. But there was never slavery based upon race until the European transatlantic slave trade began to ensue. So it has been the worst and the most vicious kind of slave trade that we have seen. And this has happened as Europe began to invade Africa for the resources that it did not have, that Africa did have. And the most important resource that Africa had was, believe it or not, was not its gold, not its silver, not its precious metals or minerals, but was the human capital. The human being was the most important capital that the slave trade, that Europe needed in order to survive. And so as we fast forward from the 1700s up to 1441, Henry the Navigator, who was a Portuguese sailor and captain, took some slaves to the Pope in Rome and received them. He gave them these slaves as gifts. So in 1487, after 1441, when Henry the Navigator gave the Pope these African slaves, a lot of people are not aware of the fact that it was the church that made a declaration or issued a decree in form of a papal bull that allowed and authorized slavery from the Catholic Church of the people of Africa. And then as you begin to look at the slave trade and you begin to deal with the slave trade, now we move forward to the 1400s or the 15th century, and we begin to see the slave trade begin to ensue on the banks of Europe and on the shores of America. As we move forward, this has devastated 500 years of slavery. 500 years. 500 years has devastated, actually 1,300 years, but 500 years in particular of slavery based upon race, upon one's color, has damaged the psyche. It has damaged the mind. the emotions, and has damaged the DNA, because DNA retains memory. So that we're talking about genetic or intergenerational trauma that has been transferred intergenerationally. And we want to find a way, by looking at this history, as we move forward in this history, and we move forward to our own present time, coming on forward, looking at what we've been asked to do in this society, all the way up, fast forward 460 years into this slavery based upon race, to the civil rights movement back in the 60s and 70s. And we get to 1964 and the Voters' Rights Act of 1964. And we find out that when we finally, after the Emancipation Proclamation of the 1800s, that slavery really did not end, because they went back to the law books after the Emancipation Proclamation was passed, and they put other laws on the books that if you did not have a job, you could be arrested in the southern states for a crime called vagrancy. And you were picked up, taken to a prison, and you were still enslaved, because once you were turned loose, if you didn't have a job, plantation owners got together with the legislators, and they found a way to make you come back to the plantation and work. And if you didn't come back to the plantation and work, there was a law called the vagrancy law. And then you were taken to prison where you would work for free and then sublet back out to the plantation owners to work for free again. So slavery really did stop under Jim Crow. So after the Emancipation Proclamation, Jim Crow laws came into existence. And we move all the way from there to 1964. And we finally think that, okay, civil rights movement got us equality. But what really happened? What really happened in the civil rights movement? Now, I'm thankful because I have a civil rights leader on this line right here tonight, a civil rights leader who was in the move, can tell us about it, tell us whether or not we really actually gained civil rights. They turned us loose after a 460-year head start and said, okay, we're going to pretend that slavery didn't happen. We're going to pretend that there was no damage to your mind. There was no damage to your emotions. There was no damage to your DNA. Your DNA and your genes did not retain the trauma of 460 years of a complete nightmare of torture and the most horrid kind of abuse done to humanity ever seen or witnessed on this planet. We're going to pretend none of that happened. We're going to say now that we built the railroads, now that we built massive wealth in this country, now that we have all of the industries, the factory, manufacturing, textiles, we have the industries all set, we have all of these, we have our education system in place, we have our financial system in place, we have transportation in place, we have communication in place, we own all of this, we own every corporation, you own nothing. Let's say we are all equal with you owning nothing, just coming out of slavery, coming to the civil rights movement. Let's just pretend none of that happened. We're all equal. How does that work in your mind as a civil rights leader, Brother Assar Imhotep, a.k.a. Willie Carey? What do you feel when you hear me talking about equality for us as a people coming out of the midnight of slavery and the dark, nocturnal pain of 460 years? And all of a sudden, now the system tells us, okay, let's integrate, we're equal. How do you feel about that?
That is an affront. That is an affront in the classical sense of the word. Because when we had our movement here in Houma, you know, we did not allow any out group decide and determine for us what the struggle was about. But somewhere along the line, we got sidetracked. We were not here in Houma fighting for integration. We was fighting for better quality education. We was fighting for access to a high-paying job, not because we were black, but because we were qualified. And all of a sudden, a lot of those things that we was fighting for were kind of sidetracked, and they felt and believed that simply because we were allowed to go in the front door of the Purple Cow, because we were able to go down to the local established eateries and sit in the front with them, go in the white, go in the bathroom with white people and stuff, that everything had been resolved. But the whole thing, the whole struggle was not about any of those physical things, you know. And I agree with you wholeheartedly, because one of the main things that happened to us during the 60s, one of the main things that happened to us, religion was used against us. You know, they got those individuals who were in a position of power, and they assigned them as our leaders. And subsequently, the people who needed to be heard were not heard. Their voice was muffled and stuff, and we did not do all that we could do. And even currently, you know, that the whole idea, the whole concept is that we have equality. Now, I understand, how is it that we can have equality? We got the highest amount of young people in jail. You know, we don't have justice. We're talking about just no justice, no peace. We're in a permanent state of, as you said, of a minority. It seems like it's a scam and a scheme to think that somehow we've been here all these years and our population has not risen to the point to where it's not to exceed the status quo, but somehow to measure up to that. And the civil rights thing is going to take a lot more than probably we are willing to invest in it. And those fundamental things that we need to do, it seems like it's a laughing thing. We don't register. We don't register, and we don't vote. We don't take part. We somehow opted out of that. Even down to the school system, we got a lot of kids that can't read and can't write. And those who can read and can't write, I mean, those who can read and can write doesn't read all right. And somehow they don't understand that if you a person who can read and doesn't read is no better off than a person who can't read. Because if you can't read, what's important to you? If you can't read, you're not going to sit on the jury. You're going to still have the same people sitting on the jury judging us. And it's a foregone conclusion. When we go before the justice system, it's a foregone conclusion as to whether or not we're innocent or guilty. The presumptions of innocence until proven guilty doesn't exist. That's in our criminal justice system. And I maintain this, until we can come to some kind of agreement, until we can come to some kind of consensus within ourselves as to what's important to us, until we can come to some kind of consensus and agreement that, like you said, I'm a Vietnam veteran. And after I came out of Vietnam, I wasn't out of Vietnam 2 years before I was sent to Angola State Penitentiary. And after that, I got out of the penitentiary. I went to California. They said, well, most of the Vietnam veterans were suffering from stuff called post-traumatic stress syndrome disorder. And I didn't know what that meant, but I knew I had a lot of the symptoms. But I thought, well, this is just the way I've always been. That's the way I would have been. But I had to go and start taking therapy and found out. And it was a long process that even to this day, I still have to go and take therapy. How then can we think that we can stay in slavery all those years of being brutalized, all those years where the United States Supreme Court tells us that you ain't got no right, that no white man is bound by law to respect, of being brutalized, being all kind of atrocities being committed against us. And then we have the responsibility of raising, being mentally healthy, mental hygiene being a top priority, supposedly, then we gonna raise our children. Traumatized people raising children can only raise traumatized children. And they carry that trauma on, and perhaps that's why we act in a lot of instances the way we act. Because not only were our ancestors traumatized, our people, our mothers and fathers was traumatized. And we ultimately are the end result of trauma. You know, so we need to understand that we do, that we are God's people. And there's a requirement to being that just going to church and this, that, and the other is not sufficient. We need to understand that we ain't got no friend here other than us. And if we turn against us, we're going to be in a worse situation, in a worse predicament in life. So I'm still doing what I do because I don't know any other way to live. I still believe that we can accomplish and achieve things that our ancestors back in days of yore accomplished and achieved. I still know that. I don't need nobody to validate that for me. I don't need nobody to agree with me on that. I don't need a consensus on that because I know deep in my soul who I am. I was talking to one of my favorite people, and he told me, he said, well, look, the way they did destroyed a lot of us is that when our women came here to this country with babies, they tore that baby away from the arm of his mother and set that baby over on yonder's plantation or down some other place, throw that baby down a river, whatever, and told that baby from the early beginning that you're nothing, that you're nobody. You can never be anything. You can never be anybody. And it doesn't take as long as one would suppose to convince and persuade a person. And as such, you go through life thinking I'm nobody, I'm nothing. And you're searching for validation through whatever medium you're looking for it for. You don't find that. You don't have any salvation or any deliverance here. You wait
until you hit a major point there. I want to touch on that just for a moment because I believe it was, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the doctrine of exclusion in 1638, which now you got to listen to that word, that term, or this phrase. Doctrine of exclusion meant that no person, no black person in this country, I know this was 400 years ago, almost 16, 17, 18, 19, we're almost 400 years there, but of course slavery started way before then. But in 1638, this is after 1619 when they sold the first 20 slaves there in St. James, Virginia, but there was a doctrine of exclusion that said that no black person could have any rights of any citizenship or privileges in this country. And that was a Diversity Act of 1705 that happened. But nonetheless, this is where we are right now. In this doctrine of exclusion, is still being practiced, but it's not being admitted, but it's being practiced under the cover, under the false ban, under the cloak of sophisticated terminologies like we live in a colorblind society or we are integrated now. We are integrated, but we are still excluded. And what do I mean by being excluded? You don't own any railroads. You own no transportation. You are not a stakeholder in any of the industries of transportation, in the air, on the water, on the rail, on the ground. You're no stakeholder. You have no input. You have no ownership into that. You're not owners into any of the education system because of the information that's being controlled by the Rothschild for the last 200 years of the books you read and the information that is allowed to be taught in universities and in schools, by the way. So you're not a stakeholder in the system of education. You're not a stakeholder in spite of a black president in the White House. You are not a stakeholder in the political system, in spite of all of the black legislators in Congress and the few that are in the Senate, and even with a black president. Politically, you do not have any stakes because you have been forced down, and there was an article in the New York Times that mentioned something that I mentioned a moment ago, that blacks would be forced out of the minority position as the first minority to the second minority to the third minority and then down to the fourth minority, locked in a permanent underclass position because of immigration of Hispanics and Asians. And then now, because of the tremendous incarceration system, because once you become incarcerated and become a felon, you lose all rights to participate in the political system. So you cannot vote, and even if you're released on parole or probation or whatever, you cannot vote if you are a felon. These things have locked you, these policies and programs have locked you not only in a minority position, but in a permanent underclass position where your voice is, you know, in other words, the New York, there was an article in the New York Times that said that the minority now will not be blacks. We don't have to check with blacks. in order to win in the political process now. We'll check with the Hispanics or with the Asians or others other than the blacks. So you're disenfranchised politically. You're not a stakeholder in the economic system. You control no economics. You don't sit at the table that control any economics. So while we have these cute, politically correct catchphrases like we're living in a colorblind society or we've integrated, yet and still the doctrine of exclusion in a hidden way is still being exercised, not only just in the education system, not only just in the political system, not only just in the economic system, but also in the justice system, in the criminal justice system. Now, we don't have to strain ourselves to know that or to see, and let's talk about it honestly, when we watch police officer after police officer commit cold-blooded murder on the streets of America against people of color, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Oscar Grant, and the list goes on, Trayvon Martin. More recently, the young man that just was shot in Chicago 16 times in the back. Young man shot in Milwaukee in the head while handcuffed. Freddie Gray beaten, broken. And not even, let's talk about one of the problems we have, and I'm going to pause here, because one of the problems we have, Brother Assar, is the behavior, inappropriate behavior of black people. And what do I mean by inappropriate behavior of black people? I'm stealing this phrase from Dr. Claude Anderson. Dr. Claude Anderson. Inappropriate black behavior of black people. Rodney King is snatched out of a car in 1992. He's beaten. His teeth are knocked out of his head. He has a concussion. His jaw is cracked. His ribs are fractured. He's kicked. He's stomped. He's bleeding. And he's being whipped by several police officers with a weapon. And he gets out and he says, "Can we all get along?" That's inappropriate black behavior. While you're being stomped, while you're being kicked, your teeth are being knocked out, your skull is being cracked, your ribs are being broken, your kneecaps are being busted, and you're saying, "Can we all get it?" That is inappropriate behavior. So we've got to deal with something here in the black community, and that comes from another term that came about in 1710, which where a young man on a slave ship called the, I believe it was called the Eagle, 1704, a slave ship and a 19-year-old slave was on the slip. The slaves attempted a revolt. They attempted to overthrow the crew and the captain, turn the ship around and turn it and take it back to Africa. And they had almost been successful. But a 19-year-old slave, young man, as one of the revolters took a machete and was going toward the captain and was about to slay the captain, and this 19-year-old slave jumped in the way of the machete, got his arm chopped off, and saved the captain's life, and therefore put the revolt to an end. The captain was able to regain control of the ship and bring the ship on to America. But this young man was rewarded. And so what they did was is that they passed a thing called meritorious manumission. And I want you to hear this carefully. Meritorious manumission. And I'll say that one more time, a third time. Merit, like the word merits, like you get merits for doing something good. Meritorious manumission. And this was a policy that if any were black people were rewarded, any black person that saved a white life is rewarded. If you protected white property, you were rewarded. If you created an invention that white people could get rich for, you were rewarded. And fourthly, if you informed on other black people, you were rewarded. That's meritorious manumission. So now we have the same thing It's happening right now. The Rodney King syndrome. We have the 19-year-old slave on the slave ship who jumps in the way of our own people because we are being rewarded when we protect white supremacy. We protect and save white life. We protect white property. We invent something that will make white people rich. Or we inform on other blacks who are trying to be empowered. That is mandatorious manumission. Now, I hate to say this as a preacher myself. I hate to admit this, and I know Pastor Abbott is on the phone. If he hasn't gotten off already, let me see if he's gotten off. I hate to say this, but let me see if he's here before I jump down here. Pastor Abbott, take yourself off of mute. Push star 6 if you don't mind, if you're there. I want to hear your voice. Pastor Abbott. Are you still there? Pastor Abbott, can you hear me? All right. Brother Curry, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I can hear you loud and clear.
Okay. Well, I don't know if Pastor Abbott got off the line with us or not, but let me say this. Now, I'm getting ready, Brother Curry, to say something reckless, and I want you to stand with me.
Yes, sir.
If you can. If you can't, I have to be thick-skinned enough to say, okay, you can't stand with me. But the thing, the major problem that's standing in the way of black people rising up and becoming conscious and understanding this message that we're talking about, the greatest obstacle is the black preacher standing in the black pulpit. Now, I'm going to base that on scripture. I'm going to base it on Luke 11 and 52 and Matthew 23 and 13, where it says that the priests and the Pharisees stand in the door. They won't come in the kingdom, and they won't let anybody else in either. Luke 11, 52 says that the lawyers, which are the leaders, the teachers, the rulers, hold the key of knowledge. They won't come in, and they won't open the door and let anyone else come in. So it is our religious leaders that are preventing us and who are locked in at different levels of deceptions for different reasons. Some are being rewarded by the system to be watchdogs over the rest of us so that we can't wake up and wake the people up. How do you feel about that? I think you kind of touched on that a moment ago, but now I just kind of let the cat out the bag. I opened up Pandora's box. I just spilled the beans. What do you have to say about that?
Yes, sir. I'm in total agreement with that. I'm not just limited and restricted to right here in Houma, Louisiana. I've traveled extensively, not only throughout the South, but throughout this country. And I find if you reflect back to the early 50s, when they were conducting voters registration drives over in Shreveport, Louisiana, those individuals who were leading the charge, if you will, were ministers. Even in my hometown, the individuals leading the charge were ministers and principals of schools and stuff. Those were the individuals who were leading the charge. If you could remember back in during the early 60s, they had an organization called Deacons for the Defense of Justice. These individuals were mostly deacons and preachers and stuff, but somehow they transitioned from being in the forefront in a leadership position, doing what God loves, doing what God demands and requires. They've transitioned. You know, they've become, how can I say it? It's a saying that says a continued adherence to the status quo is the largest obstacle to progress. And they got a status quo that's been established by someone other than black people, if you will, and they adhere to that. They've made the church into a Sunday morning disco. You know, we go up in there, we hoop and holler, and we sing and shout and pray, and we leave and come on, and our state of being doesn't change. I feel as if it's a greater responsibility that God calls you for, that God anoints you for, other than a Sunday morning disco, an emotional outburst. That's not necessary leadership. When I was in Vietnam, I was a platoon sergeant. Before I got to be a platoon sergeant, I was a squad leader. And I had a great responsibility, not only for myself, not only for the immediate individual who were under me, but for the other individual in the platoon, other individuals within the company, in the battalion. And my life was out there on the line, and I had no doubts whatsoever about the consequence of my involvement, as are these preachers here. You know, and I'm not making a blank indictment of all preachers everywhere, but I'm saying those that I've witnessed, those that I've experienced, seem as if somehow they've lost their way. You know, they've lost that concern and that interest in the sense that they want to keep themselves out of harm's way. They want to be able to satisfy the status quo. They want to go downtown and be accepted in that arena that that governs not only the town or the parish, but the state. You know, so I'm in total agreement. I'm glad that you brought those words to bear, simply because somebody got to tell the truth. The truth stands on its own. You know, just look around. You don't have to have a CNI dog to see what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, where are they? Where are they? One of the major problems in a little small town like Homer is a lack of leadership. But we've been looking to the pastors and the preachers for a leadership. There's no leadership here. There are no leaders. It's just like a long time ago, I used to like to watch cowboys and westerns and stuff. When they would kill that Indian chief, the rest of the Indians would scatter because they didn't have leadership. And that's where we are. We don't have a leadership. And historically, our leadership has come from the church. But once they snatched that rug out from under the preachers, the so-called leaders, we ran astray. We ran them up.
What do you do when they're being rewarded? We're talking about meritorious manumission, where you're being rewarded. I mean, that you're being given, in some cases, you know, concessions, positions, favors, money, to be supportive of a system that's oppressing your people. Now, I really don't want to call any names, but we have some high-profile people in our culture right now that have gotten rich and wealthy and become millionaires. They've been poverty pimps and have profited from the pain and the pathos and suffering of the black community. Every time there's a black problem, certain ones rush in. And we know who they are. I don't have to call their names. You can use your imagination. They've gotten multi-filthy rich multi-millionaires by profiting from black pain, while the rest of us are in an illusion. And there is a deep deception that's afoot and that is amiss, particularly in the church that I am a part of. There is an illusion and a deception that if we pray and if we do this and if we do that, and we have not really fully, totally understood liberation theology and the doctrine of liberation. Christ came to set the captives free. He said, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He has anointed me to preach the gospel, to bind up the brokenhearted, to set at liberty them that are captive, and to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. We have not set the captives free. We are not preaching liberation gospel and liberation theology because people still have the deceptive chains wrapped around their minds and wrapped around their emotions, and they're infatuated and having romantic fantasies with deception, with illusions, with non-truth, with fiction. And when you try to bring facts, when you try to bring reality, we're in love with illusions. And we need to address the fact and address the reality of our situation at this point, because as it appears, we are looking at genetic annihilation. This is not playtime. This is not something that we can ignore. This is not something that we're here to entertain with or to talk about in a sense that, oh, we have other options. No, we don't. We're looking at genetic, slow, systematic, gradual genetic elimination. These factors that we're pointing out right now are about genetic elimination. And it is up to a group to try to preserve the life of its kind if it can. There's nothing prejudiced or racial about the preservation or the love of one's own life. You can't love your neighbor if you don't love yourself. And we've been taught self-hatred. Now, let me address another issue on that note, because there's something else that needs to be addressed, and that is how what Asar alluded to a moment ago. One of the things that we need to do to come out of the illusion is to reconnect to our roots and reconnect to our history. Why, as Malcolm said, who took your name? Why did they take your name? What was your name before they changed your name? What was your history? What was your tongue? Why did they erase your history? What was so important about, let me tell you a story that I heard I believe his name is Dr. Edward Robinson, talking about the Songhai people. And when they were brought to South Carolina, and the plantation owners kept having problems out of them, revolting and burning down the houses, killing people. And they just wouldn't accept slavery. They just couldn't become a part of their mind. And so finally, plantation owners went to Germany. And when they went to Germany, they talked to this expert. And he said, well, what is the problem? He told them, well, they keep burning our houses down. They keep killing our people. And they keep revolting. We can't get them to be good slaves. He said, well, do they know who they are? He said, yeah, they know who they are. Why are you letting them know who they are? So we don't know why we're letting them. He said, well, you can't let them know who they are. You can't let them know who they are. If you let them know who they are, they're going to continue burn the houses. They're going to continue to revolt. These are the Songhai people of Nigeria. And Dr. Robinson tells this story because he's one of the descendants of one of the great sculptors and artists who was a doctor and a lawyer and a sculptor of Songhai. And he tells this story how his great-great-great-great-grandfather was a one, and he promised that he wouldn't let the Europeans come over, take his art, take it off. And his wife said, no, you can't do it. They're going to kill you, and they're going to take me in the ship and take me off like they've done everyone else. And he just couldn't stand it. They killed him. By and by, they killed him. They came and took because he fought, and his pregnant wife got on the ship. But they had passed a law that they couldn't take those people into slavery, and they had some patrol ships out in the Atlantic, and that ship ended up not going to South Carolina, but ended up going to Pennsylvania. So as a result, he was told who he was. But now backing up to what the German man told the plantation owners, he told them, he said, now you cannot let these people know who they are. Here's what you need to do. You need, when the woman is having a baby, the black slave female is having a baby, or she's coming over as a slave, she has a baby, take that baby away from that mother. Do not let that mother tell that baby who he is. Send it to another plantation. And you teach that baby that you got him out of the jungle with a loincloth and a bone in his nose. He was a savage and a barbarian. Didn't have any language, didn't have any history. You delivered him. And so this is one of the problems that we're facing right now. Even I talked to a learned, degree-lettered, striped preacher in the pulpit just a few months ago. He told me he was thankful for slavery because slavery took, look at how the miseducation of the education system had this preacher thinking that we came from a barbaric people with no knowledge, no wisdom, no intelligence, no intellect, no culture, no history. And he was thankful for slavery because slavery delivered us from the jungles of Africa with loincloths and bones in our nose. He was thankful for slavery, not knowing that we had universities, we had engineers, we had doctors, we had architects, we had scientists, we had teachers, professors, we had temples that were universities. We had a university in Mali, Timbuktu. We built a university in Spain, the University of Dijani, that still stands to this day. As the Moors went into Europe in 711 A.D. and re-educated Europe, brought Europe out of the Dark Ages, we were the ones, the black Moors of Africa, did this to Europe, bringing Europe out of the plague and the darkness of the dark ages. And yet and still, we don't know this history. We don't know this history. So Dr. Robinson talks about how his mother, great-great-great-great-grandmother, was on a ship, and they had passed a law where they could not take any more people from Sungay to South Carolina because they were just into slavery, because it was just too hard, because they knew who they were. And so, and one of these people, the slave traders, they didn't pay the law any attention. Of course, they did it. But they were caught by a patrol ship, and it didn't end up in South Carolina. He ended up in Pennsylvania, and he knows who he is. He cannot, you cannot enslave a man that knows who he is. So when this baby was snatched from the mother and does not know his history and mixed in with other people of other language, now he doesn't know who he is. And so the main thing we have to do, Brother Curry, Brother Afsar, Brother Imhotep, is to know who we are. You believe? Do you agree with that?
I agree wholeheartedly. Let me take a step back for 1 second here. You were talking about a liberation theology, and I maintain that we now substitute our liberation theology with a theology of prosperity. You know, somehow assuming that once you get a dime over bean money, all your problem will disappear. And I see that all the time around here. When I talk to the young people around here about who we are, if you don't know who you are, you're going to gravitate to that which you know. You know, I talk to a lot of young people. I say, do you know who Abraham Lincoln was? Yes, sir. He was the emancipator. He signed the Emancipation Proclamation. Do you know who George Washington was? Yes, sir. He was the first president of the United States. Do you know who Dessalines and Toussaint Louverture was? Who? Do you know who Dr. Claude Addison is now? Who? You know, but on the other hand, any other people that you can talk to know, have some kind of knowledge of themselves. And as you said, it's a deliberate and intentional thing that happened way back then, but it's still prevalent to this day. We don't know who we are. We don't know. That's why we can gravitate to and embrace and clothe ourselves in stuff that has no pertaining, that does not pertain to us at all. We don't know anything about us, but we know more about this European culture than we know about ourselves, and that was deliberate. It's not the it's not a coincidence. And one thing you have to understand and realize, we can never blend in this melting pot that America is. We can never do that, but it's not necessary to blend in, because if you look at the Chinese, they got Chinatown. You look at the Korean, they got Koreatown. You look at every ethnic group that comes to this country, they got their own. And we just like that redhead stepson. You know, we run here, we run there, we run here, and we run there. And we don't even understand that what we need.
Let me jump in just for a moment and pull out some. We got about 7 minutes. You're hitting on some very critical points. Now, you mentioned there at the end about the Chinese coming in and about the Asians coming in, about the Hispanics coming in, and about the Greeks and the Italians and the Jews coming in. Now, let's stop there for a moment. Let's rub that for a minute. These people don't integrate. They don't segregate. Now, I'm stealing directly from Dr. Claude Anderson's talks and lectures, and I got to give him credit because this is his work and these are his terms. But Dr. Claude Anderson says that's two ends of the same stick, segregation and integration. So what do we need to do? What are these people doing? They are congregating. They find people that look like them.
Mm-hmm.
And
Amen.
They get with people that look like them. And the next thing you know, you've got a Chinatown. You've got a little Korea. You've got little Mexico. You got Jewtown. There's a Jewtown in Chicago. There's little Italy. There's all across America, there are these congregated communities of ethnic groups that find other people like them, and we are the only people that don't try to congregate with our own.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to start calling it out and blowing the whistle. When I grew up, there was a little district right there we called the Front. We had a garage there where Mr. Harry Hill worked on cars, and Then we had a gas station there where the Banks, Mr. Banks owned the gas station. We had a couple of cafes. We had a cleaners. We had our own cleaners. We had our own grocery store. Had our own laundromats. We had our own little, we congregated. But then in the civil rights movement, we bought into the illusion of inclusion. And brothers and sisters, let me tell you something. It was an illusion. Because although some of us have big multi-million dollar contracts, the athletes and entertainers, their agents, the agencies that they work for, the corporations that they work for will not allow them to give back to the black community. They'll go to Africa, find a village, and give to Africans, but they cannot come back. They are not allowed. Now, this is what I want to say. This is planned minority, to plan for you to be in minority. Now, what are, in the last few moments, what can we do to offset these things? What is the strategy? Now, we've been talking about the problem and analyzing the problem. We all, excuse me, know what the problem is. What are some of the things that we can do? Now, I don't know if this is the brilliant, the most enlightened strategy of all, but it looks like they're trying to eliminate our population. It looks like they're trying to take the men out so the men can't get with the women. You can't have any babies, so your numbers population is going to go down, and they're putting things in your food to increase the hormone activity to make you homosexual. That's reinforced by the entertainment industry. Keeps putting these metaphors and images of being dressed in dresses up before you. They're teaching that in schools to reinforce it in the education, entertainment industry. Then they're working on you with the medicine and the medical industry, chemical changes in your body. Now, what can we do, those of us that will fight this fight? Well, one thing that I say is reproduce. Well, creation by procreation, that we need to start procreating at a massive rate. A massive rate. Is that biblical? Yes, it is. God says, be fruitful and multiply. Psalms 127, verses 3 through 5 says, lo, children are a heritage up from the Lord, and blessed are the fruit of the womb.